Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Jurisdiction 15 Radiology Ask the Contractor teleconference. As a reminder, today's presentation is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Ms. Deanna Cruiser. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to today's CGS Jurisdiction 15 Ask the Contractor teleconference for our Kentucky and Ohio radiology community. My name is Deanna Cruiser, and I will be your facilitator for today's call. I'm pleased to mention that I am joined today by a team of Medicare experts here at CGS, and that does include our medical director, medical review staff, our CERT coordinator, our provider outreach and education, as well as our customer service teams. So together we will be taking your questions and providing you with information that we hope that you can use to help improve your billing, your documentation, and ultimately the results from your Medicare audits. Today's teleconference is the next in a series of specialty-specific educational offerings that we will be hosting for our J15 providers this year. We chose radiology as the topic for this education based on recent reviews that have been conducted for various types of radiology claims. A full report of the findings from our advanced imaging review is currently being compiled and will be available for your review in our next Medicare bulletin. We would like to clarify the advanced imaging study review edit terminated on November 15, 2011. In addition, those claims that were denied early in the edit review due to the absence of documentation to show how the results were subsequently used in the care of the beneficiary will be automatically reopened by CGS. We will review those impacted claims for a proper order, diagnosis, and interpretation. If all of those required elements are present, the claim will be paid accordingly, and no action is required by the provider. In addition, we're also aware that in many cases, documentation that was submitted in response to our advanced imaging review was not properly tracked and did cause several claims to inappropriately deny for lack of documentation. There were a number of issues that contributed to this matter, but ultimately all of those items have been identified and addressed. We have set up an immediate action plan for all of those claims that were inappropriately denied for lack of documentation when the provider did in fact submit the requested documentation, where we will automatically reopen those claims for consideration without any additional action needed from the provider. And we do apologize for the system issues that contributed to those claim denials. I do want to move toward our focus today, which is really the trends in radiology error rates. The majority of claims that we have found to be in error when we're reviewing these types of claims are related to provider compliance with Medicare requirements for coverage, coding, and documentation. The most common errors noted by Medicare auditors of radiology service claims include insufficient or missing documentation to show that all procedures or services were medically reasonable and necessary. In other words, the submitted documentation was not sufficient for Medicare auditors to determine whether the services furnished were medically necessary. The CERT contractor is now also frequently reviewing clinical records for imaging and diagnostic testing. They use the records to determine medical necessity, as well as to check for a valid signed order or intent to order. Remember, it is the billing provider's responsibility to provide all documentation needed to support a claim. We will try to assist you in obtaining needed documentation, particularly if the request originated from the CERT contractor. Examples of insufficient or absent documentation for the purposes of determining medical necessity would include no physician order or other documentation to establish the intent for the radiology service, documentation that does not support the clinical indication for testing, for example, testing that is routinely performed on nursing home patients with falls or some degree of minor head trauma. In most cases, upon review, the scan appears to be routine screening or standing orders for falls. Remember, too, that a script that contains a physician's diagnosis code is not sufficient to show medical necessity. We need additional documentation or notes to substantiate the coding of the diagnosis itself. Remember, too, that documentation and signatures must be legible. If we can't read the documentation or the signature, we're not able to give you credit for that work. So orders and radiology reports must be signed and legible. Remember, if you're submitting hospital or physician records as part of your documentation, they must also contain a legible signature. In the absence of a legible signature, we will accept an attestation statement or a signature log to authenticate the author's signature. Other examples of documentation errors would include records that were incomplete or incorrect. For example, incomplete or missing radiology reports. In many examples that we've seen, the wrong records were sent in response to a documentation request. So, for example, emergency room records were sent when the patient was actually admitted as an inpatient. Other errors would include technical errors, such as duplicate services or incorrect or missing dates of service in the record. In other words, specific documentation that is required as a condition of payment is often missing from the beneficiary's medical record. There are a few other things to keep in mind when documentation is requested by CGS or any other Medicare audit entity. If you're using abbreviations in your notes, please include a key so that the auditor can clearly understand your documentation and give you credit for the work that you've done. Also, when you're responding to a request for documentation, please always include a copy of the request letter to help ensure that the documents are routed correctly. And for CERT requests, please include the CID number from the CERT request letter with your documentation submission. Also remember, many radiology services such as MRIs, MRAs, and PET scans are subject to the coverage guidelines and limitations that are outlined in the national coverage determinations that are available from the CMS Medicare coverage database. Please make sure that you and your staff are familiar with these coverage guidelines. I also wanted to remind you that CGS has created an advanced imaging documentation checklist, which is available from our website at cgsmedicare.com. From the homepage, you can click on your state's tab at the top, so you'll choose either Ohio Part B or Kentucky Part B. From the menu on the left-hand column of that page, choose coverage and pricing, then click on medical review. At the bottom of the page, you'll find a link labeled checklist, and from there you can click on the advanced imaging checklist. This checklist provides you with detailed guidance on what information should be included in your documentation for advanced imaging services. We strongly encourage you to review this information and ensure that your documentation is compliant and could stand up to a Medicare audit. We will also include the direct links to these checklists and the Medicare coverage database in the minutes to this call for your reference. Now, we would like to reserve the remainder of our time today for questions and discussion from our participants on the phone lines. When you're asking a question, please identify yourself by name and your practice or organization. Operator, can you please open the phone lines for questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, please press star 1 if you have a question, and we'll pause for a moment to assemble the queue. And our first question comes from Melody Romano with Cincinnati Medical Billing.
Yes, hi. One of the questions that I have is regarding the advanced imaging services and the reduction when two of them are done on the same day. My question is, we have some cases where a CAT scan and an MRI are done on the same day. And they're saying if it's done in the same session that you would have reduced services on the reduced payment on the second service. We're showing that they are giving us a reduction when there are two different types of service using two different machines. And it's impossible for an MRI and a CAT scan to be done in the same session. So I'd like to know if you can clarify to us what you are showing as being the same session. What do you mean by same session?
And Melanie, if you can give us just a moment, we are conferring here on that one. Thank you for the question. Hi, this is Barbara. The description of a session does not mean the CAT scan and MRI machine being one entity. The session is describing that one professional visit. Does not mean that you're even scanning or x-raying the same body part. It's just the two types of radiology being done in one visit. That's one day.
So you're stating that a session is one day? Because there are two different modalities. I could understand if two of them were MRIs or two of them were CAT scans, but one's a CAT scan and one's an MRI.
Dr. Oates, did this happen as an inpatient or outpatient?
Outpatient.
And it was on the same day, same visit, with very little time in between?
Some of them are outpatient and some of them are inpatient. Are those reviewable? We can send those in and show they were done at different times. But I guess our clarification that we need is, what you're considering a same session.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but we've asked CMS to try and define that a little better. But at this time, what we're going on is if they're done in reasonably close proximity and they do not leave the imaging area, then that's a session. So if they had a CT, let's just take, for example, as an inpatient, they had a CT scan in the morning, and then later that afternoon, because of the CT scan, they went back and got an MRI, that would be considered two separate sessions. But if they're at your outpatient clinic and in the same day, basically, they have both done, that is considered a session.
Okay, so the difference is outpatient and inpatient and the time. So those are reviewable.
Oh, you're sending a redetermination if you can look at it.
Okay, and then I have another question just regarding the, our claims are being held up for over 100 days because they are sending them to, for MSP determination or coordination of benefits determination, and they're stating that they allow that answer to come back in 100 days, but they're not notifying the providers that such a thing is being done with that claim. So if we don't hear anything in what we consider payment or a response in a timely manner, and it's gone a couple of months, then we are re-picking that file, and we are resending it only to get a duplicate off of that because one's already in their processing. Is there any way that they can notify the provider that our claim through a code or something on the remittance advice to let us know what they are doing with that claim so that we're not refiling it thinking that you did not get it?
And Melanie, this is Deanna Cruiser. Thank you for the question. That is one that we will definitely want to research for a little bit more clarity on what's happening with those specific claims that, that you're describing. Would you mind providing me your phone number and I can follow up with you?
Certainly. It is 513-965-8041, and I'm at extension 135.
Okay. I will call you after this call to get a couple of examples, if you don't mind, and
okay.
We can take a look into the system to see specifically what's happening with those. In regard to your question as far as if there's some way to be notified on the remittance advice or things of that nature, when a claim is pended to the common working file and it's going to take longer than usual, that is actually a process. The remittance advice process is established by CMS, so it's not something that we as a contractor can arbitrarily assign a specific reason remark code to. However, I would love to take a look at some examples of that to see more specifically what's happening and see if we can get some resolution on those for you.
Okay, and actually my name is Shelley. I'm the Medicare Review Specialist here at CMBS. When you call that
Shelley.
Number, it is Shelley. And
I'm sorry about that. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead.
I just wanted to know if those points she can't do an ear. She can't put it on the Medicare voucher. Can you put that anything on the IVR to say that they're pending? If you can't do it on the explanation of...
They do have that, but you can't call on every one of those claims.
Okay.
I did want to let you know that I did talk to a Tier 2 representative today regarding some of those claims, Pam Deals, and she's just given me the same information that they allow 100 days. I think that that's a pretty long time to ask the provider to wait. I know when Medicare requests documentation from us, they only give us 45 days.
And that's a valid point. Thank you, Shelley. We will definitely take a look into it when I call you back this afternoon and see if we can find more specifically what's happening with those claims, because resolving those specific claims only resolves those specific claims. We need to know more in the grand scheme of what's happening and why those are taking so long. So we'll get you some answers. Just have a few examples ready for me, and I'll work with you on this one.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And we'll go next to Kim Lillis with the University of Louisville Hospital.
Actually, this is Melanie. We have several people in the room here. I have a couple questions for you. The first is related to medical necessity and the number of diagnosis codes that you're accepting or acknowledging when we send our claims. Are you accepting and acknowledging the reason for visit codes as well as the diagnosis codes? And with regard to the secondary diagnosis codes, how many secondary diagnoses are you accepting and recognizing as valid?
And Melanie, this is Deanna again. Good question. On your line item, when you're submitting the claim, are you referencing multiple diagnoses that are linking back to that code, or are you just listing the diagnosis codes in the diagnosis field?
Just listing the diagnosis codes in the diagnosis field.
Okay. In order for us to link that diagnosis back to that particular radiological procedure, we need you to use the field in your electronic format that links those two together to give us those additional diagnosis codes. So if you want us to link that procedure to your first two diagnosis codes on the claim, for example, we would need you to reference both of those in that electronic field. Does that make sense?
Well, I don't work for the business office, but it sort of makes sense.
Okay, that's okay. There is a field, and I can kind of tell you where it's at on your paper claim form. Of course, your electronic format should match up to that. But it's item 24, and there's a diagnosis pointer section in item 24. If you wanted us to take a look at the first two diagnoses, for example, you would actually indicate 1, 2 in that field to get us to link that procedure to the first two diagnosis codes.
Is this for the go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Is that for the professional side or for a facility? Because we're billing the facility side here.
And these would be for professional claims. Actually, this call is dedicated to Part B professional services.
Okay. On the professional side, do they use reason for visit codes as well?
Reason for visit codes on the electronic claim?
Yes.
We, on the professional side, we're looking at diagnosis codes, ICD-9 codes.
Okay. And then I guess you may have answered this question in your beginning remarks, but I just want to clarify. When we receive a request for additional information and it says all documents to support, when you're requesting all documents to support the claim, is there a specific definition for that? How do we know what you mean by all documents? Do you just mean the order and the results, or
how's that defined? Okay, fair enough. Are you familiar with the documentation checklist that we referenced in the opening remarks?
No, but I did make a note of where to find it.
Very good. And I'm actually going to, as I said, in the minutes to today's call, I'm going to make sure that we provide the specific links there. I know I didn't provide them in the opening remarks just because some of those links get rather drawn out. But there is an Advanced Imaging Services documentation checklist that's been developed by CGS. It is our local checklist. It's not required, but it certainly will help you quite a bit whenever you receive a request for documentation. It lists all of the things that we would potentially be looking for to help support the medical necessity for the service that you're rendering. So, for example, the first item is an order or a documentation of intent, and then it goes through specifically what we would be looking for in the order, as well as what documents might serve as intent by the physician. So it really goes on to great detail as far as examples of things and different things that we would be looking for there.
Okay. Thank you. And one more question before I let you run away to the next person. Will you offer a session like this for the facility side?
Well, that is certainly a great suggestion, and I am going to make a note of that right now to take back to our counterparts on the Part A side of our J15 contract, and I will pass that suggestion back along to them, and we can certainly work with them to try to organize that. The reason that we felt today's call was necessary on the professional side, as I said, was based on a recent review that we've completed, as well as some other reviews of professional radiology services, which kind of prompted us to do this one today. The Part A institutional side may be doing some similar outreach and efforts, and we can certainly work with them to coordinate that.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the suggestion.
And our next question comes from Jennifer Wenning with Medical Imaging Physicians.
Good afternoon. I was wanting to ask, in reference to the 2010 fee schedule adjustments, I've recently come across some claims that instead of a fee adjustment, they're actually asking for the entire payment back and then denying it because another physician was paid for the same service. And it's coming to light that the emergency room doctor billed for the same service as a professional component and was paid in error because at the time in 2010, my radiologist claim was received first, but because my radiologist NPI number got picked first, this is the claim that is being adjusted because of the fee schedule, and they're seeing that they paid another provider. So even though my claim was received first, it is being taken back, and I'm being penalized for it. Customer service has told me that I need to send a redetermination request on all of those. Is there any other action that we can take on it to speed that up?
And, Jennifer, this is Deanna again. Your question makes perfect sense. And I'm glad to hear that you have contacted customer service to seek their guidance on it. I would agree with their guidance that redeterminations would be appropriate to appeal that claim decision with documentation to show that you did, in fact, perform that service on that date of service. I can tell you that if another provider was already paid for the same service on that same date of service, then that overpayment is going to have to be collected first. We're going to have to recoup that money from the other provider that was paid in error before we are able to issue payment to you. Because if we didn't, obviously, we'd have payment for the exact same service going out to two different providers on the same date of service, and our system will not allow us to do that for obvious reasons there. So do you know whether the other provider has been in the process of repaying that money back to Medicare that was paid in error?
Well, I doubt it, because if they were paid, they probably weren't aware that we submitted the claim as well, or they figured that our claim was received after theirs and then denied.
Okay.
So you're saying that even though my claim was received first, in these fee adjustments, they can't look at those before they actually deny it and determine which one was received first before they deny it and just get right to the correct recoupment?
That's an excellent point, Jennifer, but keep in mind, too, with these fee schedule adjustments from 2010, those were many, many, many thousands upon thousands of adjustments of claims that came in on a daily basis, and we're having to go back through the system and adjust each and every one of those, sometimes just pennies on the dollar, to make those very minor fee schedule adjustments that needed to happen. In most cases, those fee schedule adjustments were automated, so there wasn't actually a person that was going through and comparing claims and figuring out the order and the pricing and so forth. They were automated edits that were sent to us by CMS. So I do recognize what you're saying and the difficulty that you've had there. And, in fact, as I say, I do believe that redeterminations is going to be your best line of recourse here. But if you wouldn't mind giving me your phone number as well, we can check a couple of things in our system before we send you through that process to make sure that everything is as it needs to be first, and then send in the appeal.
Okay. My number is 937-433-7622, and I'm extension 101.
Okay, thank you, Jennifer. I will call you this afternoon.
Okay, and is there any timeline on when the fee adjustments will be completed?
And I'm looking around the room here. I don't know that we have a specific answer in-house here. Was there anyone on the phone line joining us that had that, anyone from CGS that had that information? And it sounds like, no, we don't have that right now. What I'll do is make a note here to do a little bit of research internally to see what the status of those adjustments are and how many are pending and so forth. And we can certainly put some information out to address it online, and then also include that information in our minutes to today's call.
Okay, thank you very much.
Actually, before I let you go, it seems that we do have a quick update to respond to that. Those adjustments will be completed within the next 2 weeks is what I'm hearing information coming in right now. So within the next couple of weeks, those should be completed.
And are you hearing the grand applause?
That's wonderful. I know that it's certainly one of those things that's time-consuming for both us as a contractor as well as our providers in having to go back and make those adjustments. So two more weeks and that should be complete.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from Pam Cherry with Louisville Radiology Imaging.
Hello. I wanted to ask, you mentioned in your introduction that if the radiologist had trouble obtaining the information that you needed to do the audit on the advanced imaging service, that you would be able to help us. And we have a situation where a patient came to a hospital to have an outpatient exam that was part of the advanced imaging audit. And the physician that ordered the exam actually is not even on staff at the hospital, but they just sent their patient there as an outpatient to have the scan done. And we have requested the records from the physician many times, and I guess they're a little confused about why we would need records on what he or what decision-making he did once he received the results of the scan. So we were able to get the order and some of the other things that the hospital had on file, but what would you be able to do to help us get the information we need? Because that one has been denied, and it's simply just because we can't get the information.
Okay, Pam, thank you so much for that feedback. We do have staff available here in our medical review team that are wonderful liaisons between the provider and the and tracking down documentation when it is requested. And if you don't mind, I would love to get your telephone number and pass you along to one of our medical review staff, and we can see what we can do to intervene and kind of move the process along for you.
Okay. It's area code 502-753-4949. And then I just had one more quick question. So if we were denied one of the audits for this reason or for medical necessity, and I realize that this call is dedicated to Part B, but will you be seeking to get a reimbursement back on the technical side? Because if we can't get paid on the professional side, it would make sense that the technical should not be paid as well, because as radiologists, when we don't really have any control over things like what the physician did, what their decision was once they received the results of the scan, it seems to me if we can't, that they shouldn't get paid.
Yeah, and this, Dr. Oakes, we are looking at the potential for doing that. We just haven't been able to make it happen just at this point in time. It's definitely something we are looking into because we realize the mutual arrangement that you have there.
Okay. It just seems like it would help with accountability because once this audit came in, you know, the onus was put on the radiology group to get records that we don't even own that we had to go chase down, and nobody really wanted to help us be accountable for the exam that was done. And it was just very difficult when it was only our money being affected, so people didn't really want to lend out their hand.
I totally understand. And that's something we'll figure into any future edits that we do of this nature. But that said, I don't plan to do one in the very near future.
Okay.
Now, that's not to say the CERT or the RAC would not do one, but I don't intend for us to do one on advanced imaging.
Okay.
Anna, back to you.
Thank you. We'll take our next question.
And we'll go next to Jerome Furrow with Beckley Appalachian Hospital.
Yes, I have a question. I was actually referring to the first question that was asked around the separate sessions regarding the CT head that would be performed in the morning, say around 9 o'clock without contrast, and then after the reporting, patient gets transferred to an observation patient, and then the radiologist reads that there's a need for contrast 12 hours later. Is there a way that we could charge those separately, or do we still combine those as a CT head with and without contrast?
Dr. Oakes, that's another great question, and that has not been well defined. I think if the initial clinical indication was that you needed just a CT without contrast, and say for a head injury, then the patient was taken to observation and 12 hours later was found by the radiologist to have let's just say a tumor, I'm just pulling that out of thin air, or an area of radiolucency that just wasn't quite normal and he wanted to enhance it, then that would probably be considered two separate sessions. But again, we're talking more on the inpatient side, not necessarily on the outpatient side. Observation being considered hospital-based.
Okay, so there would not be a modifier that we could place on that to find out?
I'm going to have to defer to others on the modifiers.
Yeah, modifier 59.
Modifier 59? Okay, I appreciate your help.
Okay, and again, you know, if you do get one you think is inappropriately denied and you get good documentation to support it, we do encourage redeterminations. We are still working with CMS to try to get further clarification published by them.
Okay, thank you.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, it is star one, and we'll go next to Susan Stein with Jewish Hospital.
Yes, hello. My question has to do with conditional orders. If a woman has an abnormal mammogram, can the radiologist go ahead and do a biopsy or some other more definitive test if there's a conditional order written by the gynecologist?
What does Joint Commission say about that? Because most of the time they don't like conditional orders.
That's what I thought, and that's what we've always been told. But when I looked at your checklist that you referenced at the beginning of the seminar, I'm looking at it, and it says it addresses conditional orders. And it does it in two different areas, so it's a little confusing. It says if imaging services are repeated or advanced based on conditional orders from the treating physician, those conditions must be documented and supported by the interpretation of the initial test report.
Dr. Erick, this is Sonia. If you don't mind if I jump in here for a second.
I was hoping you would.
When they're talking about those types of conditional orders, actually CMS mentions them in the manuals as well. What they're talking about is when a physician sends a patient in for, let's say, an abdominal series. And the order says, may do barium swallow as indicated after abdominal series. It's those types of conditional orders mm-hmm. where they actually lay out step by step, if A equals this, then you may do B.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
But to have the radiologist choose to continue testing without those orders laid out, I don't think that's what the intention is. I think the intention is then the radiologist would contact the ordering physician and go from there.
It's actually the treating physician who has approached me and said, that's really not good for patient care, and I think that that's a waste of the radiologist's time. There's an abnormal mammogram. Why send that patient home, make them come back, and have to wait? You know, this is a woman's nightmare.
Yeah, I don't disagree whatsoever. In fact, I totally concur. But what is generally the case is the radiologist picks up the phone, calls the treating physician, and says, hey, I found this. I think it really needs a biopsy. Do you mind if we proceed? And he gets that verbal order at that time and has it followed on by a written order.
That's what I suggested. But if the physician is unavailable, then they can do the documentation that the phone call was made and they were unavailable and go ahead and...
Yep. And that's pretty clearly delineated in the manual that they can do that if it's something of that intensity.
As long as it's documented. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Please document it.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think the intent was that you send the patient home and then have them come back.
That's the intent?
It's not
the intent.
Not the intent.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm particularly lenient on mammograms because I understand the emotional aspect of that, having been in private practice and dealt with similar situations. So I'll try to work with you to support you on that anyway.
Oh, great. I appreciate that. I'll let her know.
Anything further, caller?
No, that's it.
Okay. And our next question comes from Sue Donofrio with Medical Imaging Diagnostics.
Yes, hello. We have a situation where we do a lot of people that are in group homes, and these women are mentally challenged. We have a problem doing mammograms on them. Sometimes they're very combative. Other times they're very afraid that they don't know what's happening to them. So we have a written order to do an ultrasound instead, and these ultrasounds are all being denied.
Yes, ma'am. This is Dr. Oakes. I can address that. I have actually checked with several breast cancer specialists. I have looked at all the guidelines, and ultrasound screening for mammogram is not first-line test. It's still a mammogram.
We understand that, but we can't do mammograms on them. I mean, some of them can't even stand. They come in wheelchairs. And other ones get so combative and fearful that we can't get them to stand still long enough to get the mammogram done.
At this point in time, the guidelines, are, as they are written, are what we are following with Medicare. If you can have your physician send me evidence-based medicine that says differently, I'd be happy to entertain it, but I've actually looked at that pretty heavily before I responded to her.
Okay. The other problem that we have, a woman comes in with for a unilateral screening mammogram after 5 years, after a mastectomy was done, it automatically reverts back to a screening. We're putting a 52 modifier on there, and they're requesting medical records because of the 52 modifier. Is there any way we can avoid this?
Yes, actually there is. If you're able to put in the SR loop in the notepad, right breast only or left breast only, then there would not be documentation requested.
We've done that. And we're still getting, with every single one, even though we put that in the field where it's supposed to be, we're still getting a request for medical records.
Yeah, Deanna, you might want to take her information and get back and have someone get in touch with her and look at some claims.
Yeah, we can follow up.
We can certainly do that. Thank you. And Sue, what was your phone number, if you don't mind?
330-729-3643.
Okay, I appreciate that, and we will follow up to get some claim examples so we can take a further look into that for research.
Okay, and we have one more problem that we're having.
Okay.
We're doing ultrasounds as a reader, the professional component, and all we're getting is pain, lower extremity, and that's not an acceptable code. They want to rule out a DVT, but all we have is a pain code, that's all. But they're being denied because of the code.
Yes, you'll need to work with your physicians, your ordering physicians, to get more information from them.
Okay, we have talked to them, and that's all we're getting from them is just pain.
Yes, ma'am, you'll have to work with them. That's not something that we can address.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Tiffany Honey with Central Ohio Primary Care Physicians.
Yeah, I have a question about, the MRA, the head and neck. Is there a specific diagnosis list that are covered? Or is it just based on the carotid arteries, the cervical Willis, and all that stuff that's listed in the NCD?
coming soon in 2010, no, 2013, 2014, whenever ICD-10 goes in, there should be a list because they are compiling lists for all of the national coverage determinations. In the meantime, you just have to go by what's covered as far as the national coverage determination.
Okay. All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, it is star one. And for medical imaging physicians, we'll go next to Jennifer Winning.
Thank you for allowing me another question. For the person that was asking about the screening, doing an ultrasound, a breast ultrasound as a screening, I was wondering, I also had a patient who the doctor on the order underlined, quoted, bolded, under no circumstance is this patient to have a mammogram screening ultrasound. And I realized that the screening, you know, code, the screening diagnosis code on the ultrasound was denied, and that's fine. I did send in a redetermination request, and I highlighted on the order where the referring doctor specifically stated not to do a mammogram ever on this patient. However, the order did not specify why. Dr. Oakes, in your answer to the other person, are you saying that that's not enough documentation? This was very, very recently, and I've not received a response to my redetermination request yet.
Yes, ma'am. I am restating that an ultrasound is not an initial screening test based upon medical evidence that's currently out there. It's a good second line once an abnormality has been determined, but it is a very poor screening test, probably no better than doing nothing.
I see. Okay. Thank you very much. And I had another question, if I may, regarding place of service. I was wondering if there was an update on the place of service issue. I have a doctor who is in Arizona, and we are billing Noridian, being the contractor for Arizona, for him providing professional reads in Arizona on the computer for Ohio patients. I had seen some conversation that that was going to change, that we would soon be allowed to bill our Ohio contractor. And I also am in negotiations with possibly providing nursing home mobile unit services. So I'm just wondering if there's any progress being made on place of service policies.
And Jennifer, this is Deanna. That is an issue that is being circulated right now by CMS in draft format. It is not finalized, but CMS is working on developing some more clear guidance on that. They are circulating it in draft format to the contractors now for feedback and comments, and from what we're hearing, it is receiving a lot of comments, and of course, once the comment period closes, CMS will need to have an opportunity to review all those comments and decide how they want to address that in policy moving forward. So you're right on the money that it is being addressed by CMS, but give it a little bit before we can expect some final guidance on that.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And from Central Kentucky Radiology, our next question comes from Connie Wood.
You have to take your
mute. Hi.
Oh, how do I take the mute off?
Caller, your line is open. Please make sure your mute button is turned off.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead, caller.
I have a question on the recent audit. My question is, the documentation that you're requiring, is the impression from the report enough documentation to use as medical necessity when you have the report and the order from the referring physician? In other words, when the patient actually did have a stroke or actually did fracture their skull, is that enough for medical necessity? Hello?
And we're conferring. Just give us one moment, please.
the other part of that is a letter from Dr. Oak says that these claims would be reprocessed. Will that include the ones where the appeal has also been denied? Because our appeal letter says that we can bill the patient. So now are we allowed to bill the patient for these not medically necessary exams?
And Connie, let me address that piece of it, and I'll look to others to address the more clinical aspects of your question. Are you still with us?
Yes. Please ignore
okay.
the radio.
All right. I heard a little bit of noise there. Okay. So your question with regard to the claims that were being reopened that we mentioned in the beginning of the call, would that include claims that you had already taken it the next step to the appeals level? That would include those claims as well. So please, at this point, if we can ask you to hold off on billing your patient for those services, we are going back, as I say, now and reopening those claims that fell into that category for additional review. So we would ask that you please work with us on that and hold off on billing the patient.
And this is Dr. Oakes. If it's a medical necessity decision, the patient is not liable.
Well, you're... appeal letter said that we could now bill the patient.
I'm not aware of that. So okay. We'll need to find...
have it right here.
Oh, I don't disagree that you found something, but I got to find out where it come from because that's not correct.
Okay, on all of the appeals that we received back today, which is about 30 of them, and so far all of our appeals have been denied. Even though we've supplied all of the information except the documentation of where that, of what was done with that result after.
Yep. Yes, ma'am. I totally understand that. And Thea and Julian are working fervently to get those taken care of. It will probably be a couple of weeks before we can process them all, but those will be handled as long as everything else on the claim is all right.
So you're saying if the impression on the report does
no,
warrant the medical necessity, that it will be paid?
Let me push back just a little bit. The claims that we are looking at are claims where we had requested additional information to show that the result was used in the care of the patient, which would require getting additional notes from the referring physician. And we have mitigated that request or that requirement because we realize that for the time being that is far too onerous for the providers. It's something that the CERC could still ask for, it's something the RAC could still ask for, but we elected because of the impact upon the number of providers not to pursue that part of it. So to be fair to all of those that had denials because that was the only part missing, we're going to go back and adjudicate those properly. That help?
So even if they were appealed and denied?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So one more part. Earlier in the first part of the conversation, it was said that the ER notes, when the patient was an inpatient, that was the reason for denial. Even if the ER physician is the one that ordered the scan that we did, it still has to have some type of patient documentation to go with that?
The ones that I'm aware of that only had ER notes where the CT scans were done as inpatients. They weren't done from the emergency department.
But the order was from the emergency department. And because of the results of the test, they were then admitted.
No. The ones that we, to my knowledge, that were denied, and I can't speak to your particulars because I don't know what your particulars are. But the intent was to only deny them if, while as an inpatient, they got one and all that was submitted was ER notes. I think you're right. If you submitted ED notes and it showed that there was a medical necessity for the CT scan, regardless of whether they were admitted or not, if it was done within a reasonable period of time after leaving the emergency department, that would be a reasonable request.
Okay. So we're at this point, we do not have to do anything further with second-level appeals, or which we've already processed half of them to the second-level appeals.
You know, one thing I want to commend you on is you did a great job working to get the information you did, and I really do thank you for that. with that, you are correct. For those that are just waiting upon the review to make sure that everything else is in order except for how the results were used in the care of the patient, those should be, you should take no further action at this point in time. If you haven't heard something within the next 2 to 3 weeks, get back with Julie Mull and she'll look it up for you.
Okay. I will do that. Thank you.
I had one
other question,
not more of a comment rather than a question, on the legibility of the signature of the physician.
That's a requirement from CMS. That's not something we can waive.
Well, I understand that, but I think the practicality point is just that, you know, been in healthcare for 30 years and probably can count the number of physicians on two hands that signatures that I could read. But, again, you're right. It's not a statement for you. It's their policy, but just the practicality of it.
And I hear you loud and clear. I'm very much in tune with you. But, unfortunately, the OIG made a big deal about it, and as such, CMS adopted some pretty stringent requirements.
Oh, we also noticed in one of the letters that you all had taken steps to try to correct when you call the customer service line and your answers are not recorded or given to the proper next tier or not returned. We even had one today where we were called back after 4 o'clock. They left 3 messages and said they would no longer return the phone call. They left a reference number for us to call the customer service back the next morning, and then we would be given the answer. We called back this morning. The reference number only says that they called this office 3 times. It doesn't give the patient who they were even answering the question on.
Okay.
No information whatsoever.
Let's let Deanna pick your contact number if she can get that information from you and follow up with you.
Okay.
Thank you. And is this Connie?
Pardon me?
Is this Connie?
Yes.
Connie, great. I would love to follow up with you to get that information. You are correct. We're certainly trying to track down instances of things like that happening so that we can help to ensure that it does not continue. May I have your phone number, please?
Area 859-219-0542, extension 222.
222. Okay, thank you very much, and I will follow up with you directly on this, and we can certainly work to track this down, okay?
We kept the reference number and everything. So.
That's perfect. That's what I need.
Okay.
Thank you.
And this is Dr. Oaks. Yeah, that's a great segue, and if you do call the customer service staff, please get a name or a reference number. So if there is a concern, you can let us know, and we can try to provide proper education to that individual.
We did. We got both.
Excellent. That helps so much in remedying this problem because we are dedicated to fixing it, I promise you. And it has gotten a lot better. It's just not perfect yet. Deanna?
Thank you. And I would like to just tag on to one other comment that was made in reference to the legibility of signatures. I will remind everyone that we do accept signature logs. So if you know that the signature is going to be illegible for our purposes or any purposes, and there's a signature log on file, we would certainly request a copy of that to send along with your medical record documentation, and we can accept that as a valid signature when it's matched to the signature on the documentation or the order. And in the absence of that, we also have an attestation statement that's available on our website as well. We'll provide the links to that statement in the minutes to this call, and many of you may already be using it and familiar with it, but we do accept the attestation statement in the absence of a signature at all or a legible signature. So you do have a couple of additional options out there, and we'll work with you as best we can to make those tools available to kind of ease that requirement of the physician signature when they're not legible. Okay, thank you again for the feedback and the comments on that one, and we will take our next call.
Thank you. We'll go next to Joanne Wellish with Dr. Helen Thomas.
Hi. I had two separate issues that I wanted to bring up. The first one was for billing that we do for an IDTF. We were rolling along fine, and then all of a sudden in February we started getting denials, 185, saying that the rendering provider was not eligible to perform the service build. And when I called the first time, I was told that it was a system error and I should refile, and then the denials came back again. And when we called the second time, we were told that this was a problem and to check the CGS website for when this problem will be cleared up, and it maybe had to do with advanced imaging. But we haven't been able to find anything, and I think it was just kind of an odd situation here. I was wondering if you knew anything about it.
And this is an issue that I know, I'm not familiar with, and locally here in our conference room, we don't have any specifics. Is there anyone else from CGS that has anything on that one?
Hi, this is Juan. I kind of recall a situation a while ago, but what I'll need to do is get some specifics from you. So can I get your name and number and give you a call back?
Yeah, my name is Joanne, and my phone number is 216-595-6871.
Okay, Joanne, this is Juan. I'll give you a call back, and if you can just provide me with an example of what you have. That'll
sure.
help a whole lot.
Great. Okay.
Right.
And then, sure. The other thing I had, too, was that has to do with the claims that we're sending down that have 52 modifiers on them, and we're getting requests back for additional information. When we do send the claim down, we do have the description in the notepad. For an example, if we're sending a wrist to view the code for that, but we're only doing one view, we put down one view as the reason why the service was reduced, but we continue to get the letters. What else can we put in there to maybe stop these letters? And then when we do get the letters, we answer them within a week, but then they're denied again on an EOB, and we have to refile them because we can't review them, and we have to do the letter again. We've done some of these like up to three times already trying to get them paid.
Hi, this is Sonia, and we are going to take that back to medical review and see what we can do, because if there is something in the SR notepad, we should be able to pay it based off that and only request documentation if it's really unclear. So we're going to take a look at that, and we'll get back with Deanna so she can put something out.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
And Joanne, before we move on, I wanted to add to that as well, for your benefit and everyone else on the call as well. We are very excited to announce that in the near future, we will be rolling out an initiative whereby you will be able to fax documentation to accompany your electronic claim at the initial time of your submission. We're not currently set up for that. However, we are in the final stages of developing that process, and we think that that will really help to ease a lot of this type of issue or hardship on the provider, such that you're able to send that documentation at the time that you send your electronic claim, as opposed to waiting for us to request it from you, or in your case, just kind of the back and forth. So we are very excited to be able to announce that that is coming soon, and more information will be coming out via our website and listserv as those plans are finalized. And before we let you go, Joanne, would you mind if we contact you for examples from your specific claims with the 52 modifier?
I have a lot of them, so no problem.
Okay. I know we would like to take a look into that one more, just to make sure that we have what we need on those. So the number that you gave us for follow-up on the IDTF issue is where we can reach you?
Yes, so 216-595-6871. That's a direct line.
Thank you very much.
I'll get those, Deanna, when I call her.
Okay. Great. Okay. Well, Juan will get that information from you as well. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Deanna, this is Dr. Oaks. I'm going to have to drop off the call now. I just want to thank everyone for joining in. It's been a great call, a lot of good comments, a lot of good questions. We really appreciate you working with us, and maybe we'll have another one soon, but we will look into having a Part A as a contractor call for radiology, too. I think that will be great. And with that, everyone have a great day.
Thanks for joining us, Dr. Oaks. And operator will take our next question.
Thank you. We'll go next to Lori Jenkins with ProSkin Imaging.
Hi. I'm referring to a CMS manual system update dated February 3rd, 2012, and we generally bill Part B. We do reading services for hospital facilities that are out of state. We do generally bill with Place of Service Code 11. But according to this article, it's stating that we can bill with the place of service where the technical component was actually rendered. And I was just wanting to confirm that.
And if you'll give us just a moment, we want to see if we can pull that up to reference it ourselves.
Sure.
Just one moment, please.
Okay.
And get to go back to the deal with you people? Yeah, I talked to the executive, and I got to just come in letterhead and do all this other bull stuff in order to correct their mistake. I mean, they loaded it by one number off. Oh, I know, but it's just...
And I'm sorry for the delay. We're conferring internally here, and unfortunately, I don't have that in front of me right at this moment. However, based on our recent conversations with the CERT audit contractor as well as with CMS, it appears that there is additional clarification coming in the near future on that.
Okay.
And this is very similar to the question that arose a little while ago about place of service and technical versus professional components and this type of thing. So additional clarification is forthcoming on that, but at this time we would ask you to continue billing as you have been.
Okay.
And not change any billing practices until we do receive that additional clarification.
And will that clarification come to us on the website or via email, or how will we get that?
Well, both, actually, yes. If you're signed up for our listserv, that is, of course, the fastest and easiest way that we can make those types of updates available to you. However,
okay, I am.
Okay, great. And whenever anything comes out on our listserv, we also publish it on our website as well, so you can certainly check back with us there. Or if you're not seeing anything in the near future, of course, feel free to give our customer service agents a call, and we'll be happy to do some more research for you.
Yeah, because this is the effective date is April 1st. The implementation date is April the 2nd. That's in like 8-9 days. So we were preparing to go ahead and change our place of service code according to this manual, but you're saying we should just hold off on that?
Yes, I believe that's going to be our official guidance at this point. It is not uncommon for CMS to release something and then a little while later to rescind the guidance or to, and I'm not necessarily saying that that's what happened in this case, but it's certainly not uncommon, and I know that this issue is still circulating around CMS right now.
All right, I'll let our directors know.
Okay. Thank you for the question.
Mm-hmm.
And our next question comes from Maggie Ratliff with Appalachian Regional Healthcare.
Hi, this is Maggie, and thank you for taking my call. My question is in regard to the imaging guidance used for paracentesis procedures. On the physician side, on the performing physician side, that physician would bill with CPT 49083, which is a paracentesis with imaging guidance. On the radiologist bill, can that physician bill with 76942, which is the ultrasound guidance, supervision and interpretation, even though that component is included with the performing physician's code?
Okay. give us one moment, Maggie. We're going to take a look at those codes quickly for you.
Okay.
And while we're looking at those codes, may I ask, are these physicians members of the same group?
No, they are not.
Give us just another moment, if you don't mind.
Okay.
All right, Maggie, we've done a quick look here at those codes, and it does appear that, as you said, the 76942 is truly considered to be an integral component of the 49083. With that, it would probably not be allowable if those two codes were billed in the system together. Truly, the 49083 is a comprehensive code that does include that radiological guidance.
Okay, then I have a question about the documentation. If the radiologist does not have a component of the service and they do not read the images, then what type of documentation is needed in the performing physician's records to support the with imaging procedure? Just the mention of imaging guidance used, or must we store the documents, the images, for view if we're audited?
Maggie, this is Barbara. It depends on why the abdominal paracentesis study is being performed, actually.
Well, for example, if a patient has ascites and they need to have the fluid removed and they have to have the imaging guidance for the needle placement.
Well, then the interpretation, I would assume is what you're talking about, the interpretation
yes.
would give how much fluid is present, where the level is of the fluid. If, you know, generally the if that's all that's going to be stated in the interpretation, it's not very much that your provider is going to be documenting. And I have seen very small interpretations that there is ascites present. It fills half the abdominal cavity, or it fills just the, a portion. Are they actually doing the paracentesis at the time or inserting the catheter?
Yes, and it's normally performed like in an OR. And a radiology tech is there, and the images are stored. So then
right.
when they're stored, the radiologist will view and read all of the images stored.
I see.
So
in the
he provides the report to the surgeon, and it's stored in the record. So
mm-hmm.
now that we've removed the radiologist component, then on the physician and hospital side, what type of documentation do we need to support the with imaging code, the use of paracentesis with imaging versus using a paracentesis without imaging? Of course, it would be due to medical necessity and the patient's condition, but
right.
What documentation do we need?
The documentation certainly would require the fact that the catheter has been inserted safely and the paracentesis is performed well with removal of the abdominal fluid.
Okay.
Is that all
you
need?
Yes, that answered my question. Thank you so much.
Yes, you're welcome.
And from Western Kentucky Orthopedics, we'll go next to Ann Knuckles.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm trying to find out if you do multiple MRIs in a session, in one single session on a patient, do you need to break those down into different components with a TC and a PC, or can you bill it as one single component for all MRIs on a claim?
And Anne, let me clarify. So let's say you're doing two MRIs. Are you asking us if you can bill just one line item that would include both tests?
No. I know you have to do, you know, each test on a separate line, but on do we need to break it down into the first procedure code with a PC and then another line with a TC, that type of thing, or 26 in a TC, each MRI broken down in that way?
No, that is not required, Anne. If you are performing the global service and the
yes.
code itself has a global descriptor, then that's all we need.
Okay, for both of them. And you'll automatically reduce the technical component.
That is correct. If it's one of those that falls into the multiple radiological imaging procedure category, it will be automatically reduced according to the appropriate fee schedules for those.
Okay, very good. That's what I needed. Thank you.
This is Barbara. You are talking about outpatient services, aren't you?
Yes.
Okay, all right. I wanted to make sure.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh, thank you.
And our next question comes from Kim Lillis with the University of Louisville Hospital.
Hi, this is Melanie again. I wanted to go back to the conversation we were having about the orders. On the advanced imaging checklist, when we're requesting documentation, the checklist says that the order does not need to be signed. But the guidance that we're hearing is that we have to send you a signed order that's legible or an attestation or signature log so that they can read it. So I'm just confused. If the order does not necessarily have to be signed at the time that we submit it, it's conflicting.
Okay, Melanie, thank you for the question. And I actually do have a copy of our advanced imaging documentation checklist here, and it states, while a physician order is not required to be signed, the physician must clearly document in the medical record his or her intent that the test be performed. So what we're saying in essence is we need one of two things. So we either need a clearly signed physician order, or in the absence of that, we would need the documentation from the medical record that supports the intent for the service to be performed, and that needs to be signed. So even though the order itself doesn't have to be signed, we have to have something that's signed that asks or that clarifies the intent for the radiological service. And so if it's not the order, then it has to be the medical record that shows the intent and that's signed by the physician.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And from Professional Radiology, we'll go next to Maggie Lawrence.
Hello, thank you for taking my phone call. I just have one quick question, and it is in regards to some of our patients. Okay, except for example, we have a patient that goes to a facility in Indiana, right, and they do x-rays, and due to the medical condition, they transfer her to Ohio, where we do typically the same exact x-ray. My claims are being denied because they're telling me that they already pay another provider, another facility for this type of x-rays. What do I need to do to get this paid? Because my audits that I'm sending back to Medicare are not getting paid.
And Maggie, thank you for that question. You're actually correct there. If the master record for that patient does show that they have already had those services performed and paid, then we will not issue payment for those same services again. So our guidance on that would be that if you know you have a patient that's being transferred from another facility, to coordinate with the other facility to get copies of those records or test results that you would need to be able to use in the patient's care.
But you see, we won't be able to do that for the simple reason that we have radiology practice. We work at the hospital. Our doctors, they do the reading. They don't know whether this patient came from another facility to have x-rays. The doctors order extra x-rays. We do the job. We perform the service for this patient. I mean, how are we supposed to know that this patient came from actually another facility and have those x-rays done? Because of the medical condition of the patient, right? They transfer him from one facility to another. Why shouldn't we get paid for services that we perform?
And Maggie, I understand what you're saying. I hear the concern, and truly, we understand that if it's a radiologist that's working within the hospital, he's looking after the care of that patient and may not be aware that this was someone that was transferred from another facility. But to the point that we made earlier, if you are truly assuming care of this patient from another facility, then we would have to assume that somewhere in facility B, somebody knows that this patient is being transferred from facility A, and someone should be following that care, and those records should be, someone should be looking after to make sure that those records are coming over. We know that that doesn't always happen, and those things aren't always coordinated in that way, and truly you kind of fall into the scenario of, not knowing that and unfortunately requesting a duplicate service. As far as the Medicare program's position on that goes, the Medicare Trust Fund is not able to pay a second service on it for the reasons that we already mentioned before. However, if you see that this is a huge issue, of course, you do have appeal rights on it, but in most cases, the appeal would probably not be favorable for those same reasons.
Yeah, that is correct.
Right. And it may just be, I know it's easier said than done sometimes, but it may be an issue of trying to find some way to coordinate internally to better recognize those patients that are being transferred and so forth.
That's pretty much impossible to do.
That's the hard part. And I wish I had better news to share with you. I apologize, but
that's okay.
From a Medicare position, that's the rationale behind it, is that we just can't pay. It's in essence a duplicate service.
And there's nothing I can do, right?
Well, as I say, I mean, you have your documentation to support what was done for the patient and why,
okay.
And for those types of denials, you do have appeal rights, and so you are certainly more than welcome to continue to appeal that as far as you see fit through the appeals processes. We can't guarantee what the results of those would be, particularly given the rationale behind the original denial.
And the appeals are getting denied, so that's not helping.
All right, Sonia. Yeah, they might not be able to do anything on the Medicare payment end, but if there are facilities that are frequently transferring patients that you work with on a continual level, you might have some ability to work with them going forward on how the records are transferred.
I'd be able to work on something on that, but I don't believe that we're going to be able to find all that information prior. And even when I'm ready to do my appeals, there's going to be problems because if I call these other facilities to get medical records from patients, they are not going to give us that information either. It's going to be a big hassle with these insurances, like with these companies, for the simple reason that we are referring physicians. We work, okay, on a referral basis only. So we don't have the privilege of patients' charts and when they're going to move them from one facility to the next or what they're going to order next.
And again, it's a good question, and probably I'm assuming you're not alone in this, but unfortunately that is the Medicare position on it, and there's very little that we could do to really change the position behind it.
All righty. Okay, thanks. That's okay. Thank you.
And operator, it looks like we have time for one additional question, please.
Okay, our next question comes from Sonia Grieshaber with Marion Ancillary Services.
Yes, hi. We have a couple responses, actually, to some of the issues that were brought up earlier. Renee Patton is in my office, and she's going to ask a couple questions here.
Yes, I did have some input on the 52 modifier issue that people are getting claims for additional documentation. We are seeing, for example, I believe her name was
Joanne
called in about a wrist. She's putting a one view only in the description code. And from our experience, we have, for example, mammograms. And we're having where we have put right side only or left side only, and those have denied for additional documentation. Now, when we dig deeper into the situation, we're doing a left side, and the patient had a right mastectomy. We put the right mastectomy as the remark code so it's more specific, and they're paying it. So I just thought, you know, I might throw that information out there.
Thank you for that, Renee. And that actually is a good good thing to hear and to share with everyone. Certainly the more specific that you can be when you're providing information to us, it definitely helps us when we are taking a look at those claims so that we can make sure that we're adjudicating properly. Because as you say, if you just say one view only or one side only, that doesn't necessarily indicate which side. And we may request additional information or we may need additional information to be able to adjudicate that claim properly.
Right, and they can. We have waited for, we filled out our claims and then received denials for additional documentation. But in these situations now, we're letting it go out right from the get-go with a right mastectomy or whatever the description may be, and they're automatically getting paid because it's specific enough that you don't need further documentation.
And thank you. Thank you. That's great to hear. And before we close, in response to that as well, it sounds like we do have some new staff that's actually being trained specifically on these types of claims. So they are being routed to certain people that have the specific knowledge and know what they're looking for and where on those claims to make proper determinations. So a lot of good things happening in that area. So hopefully between that as well as you say, being more specific on the claim and providing additional information, I think you'll start to see a lot of good things there. So thank you for that. All right, and I wanted to just take a quick moment to close us out today. We are at the end of our time for this teleconference, but I wanted to thank everyone who's taken the time to join us today and remind you, too, that CGS is currently planning and conducting additional outreach for you throughout this year, so please stay tuned for additional educational opportunities coming up. We will also be posting an audio recording as well as a transcript of today's Ask the Contractor teleconference on our website in the near future. So thank you again for your participation, and have a great day.
And ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's presentation. We thank you for your participation.